good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin, and we're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, November 7th, 2018. We start with the news section. Ballot blocked. There are thousands of eligible voters in North Carolina jails, but jails don't always make it easy to vote. Ballots have been counted and winners declared in North Carolina's midterm elections. The state ACLU want to know whether eligible voters being held in county jails had the opportunity to participate and how that process works in facilities where movement and information are limited by design. North Carolina, like every state aside from Maine and Vermont, places restrictions on felons' voting rights. Those in jail, however, are eligible to vote as long as they are citizens, at least 18, have lived at their home address for at least 30 days prior to the election, and aren't serving an active sentence, probation, or parole for a felony conviction. But thousands of eligible voters serving misdemeanor sentences or awaiting trial may be stuck in jail on election day. At minimum, federal law requires that they be provided with access to voter registration and absentee voting materials. Ahead of Tuesday's election, the ACLU of North Carolina asked 8 counties for their policies and procedures concerning detainees' voting access. The letters went out to sheriff's offices, district attorneys, and elections boards in Alamance, Carboros, Edgecombe, Gaston, Granville, Guilford, Jackson, and Durham counties. We have been hearing from various places around the state that there might not be procedures set up to allow people in jail to vote, says Emily Sewell, an ACLU staff attorney. The organization asked the State Board of Elections and Ethics Enforcement whether it had issued any formal guidance on how to make voting accessible in jails, but the board turned up none, Sewell says, which means decisions on how and when detainees can get voter registration and voting by mail materials may be falling on sheriffs who run the county jails. Consider the optics, says Sewell. A lot of places in the state this election have sheriff's races and district attorney's races on the ballot. And if people who are detained in jail are not being provided access to voting, and that's a decision being made by the sheriff's office, that's problematic. According to the Vera Institute, about 15,000 people were held pre-trial in local jails across North Carolina in 2015, many of whom are in jail only because they could not afford to post bail. North Carolina law allows for multipartisan assistance teams, members of which are appointed by local elections boards, to help people who can't get to polls vote. That model is often used in nursing homes. Sewell suggests it could work for jails as well. The Durham County Sheriff's Office invites a nonpartisan voter education organization called You Can Vote to Register People in Jail to vote and help them request absentee ballots. You Can Vote director Kate Fellman says the organization encounters a lot of misunderstandings about who is eligible. I say about 9 times out of 10 that the voter has misinformation about why they can't vote or think they can't vote, and they really can, most of the time. It's around a prior felony conviction, Fellman says. The biggest misconception that once convicted of a felony, a person is barred from voting for life. In North Carolina, voting rights are restored after a felon completes his or her sentence. Fellman says You Can Vote, a project of the People's Alliance Fund, approached the Durham County Sheriff's Office about holding voter registration drives prior to the 2016 election. To date, You Can Vote has helped more than 250 voters register and nearly 300 request absentee ballots. During visits to the jail, volunteers tell detainees about what's on the ballot. This year, that means a lot of talk about the 6 proposed constitutional amendments. But because You Can Vote is nonpartisan, they don't provide candidate information. I think the hardest thing is that they don't have access to technology while they're incarcerated, Feldman says. They don't have computer access to research the candidates. Particularly in an election cycle featuring offices that directly affect the justice involved, sheriff, district attorney, and judges, candidate information is key. People who are incarcerated already lack a voice, said Sewell. This is just taking away one of the avenues they have to take part in society, contribute to their communities, and make change happen in a positive way that would affect them. We're taking away that voice by denying them the right to vote and making those who are already powerless to some degree even more powerless. Wake County isn't as proactive as Durham. You Can Vote went into the Wake jail once ahead of the 2016 election, Feldman said, but hasn't gotten permission to return since. Paul Gessner, the Wake County Sheriff's Office legal advisor, says the voter registration drives, which required staff to conduct background checks on volunteers and escort them through the facilities, had to be canceled due to a severe staffing shortage in the jail. According to the Wake County Detention Center operations manual, detainees who wish to register to vote or request an absentee ballot should write to the Wake County Board of Elections and ask for the relevant paperwork, which means they need to be well-versed in election schedules to ensure that slow mail delivery doesn't cause them to miss the deadline. For the state ACLU, the issue falls at the intersection of two of its priorities, voting rights and bail reform. This is another administrative fee placed on people who've been arrested and charged with something that violates their rights just because they can't afford to pay bail. In this case, it's the right to vote, says Sewell. This is just another instance where you're putting a burden on the poorest people in the state, and they're losing their political voice to do anything to change the fact that they are the poorest people in the state. The next news article, Walk the Walk. Progressive canvassers work long hours for low pay. Now, they're unionizing. Canvassers from the political campaigns Break the Majority and Aim Higher spent the weekend knocking on doors to gain votes for progressive candidates who support a middle-class agenda. But those canvassers had already won a decisive victory before Tuesday's election results were announced. Employees from the campaigns voted to unionize in recent weeks and were recognized by their respective political backers, a sign that the progressive campaign industry, plagued by long hours and low pay, is beginning to practice what it preaches. We are proud to have come together with overwhelming support from the Campaign Workers Guild and the North Carolina Democratic Party. Break the Majority field organizer Grayson Barnett said in a statement on Thursday, I am hopeful that this agreement will lay the groundwork for future campaigns in the South to unionize. Break the Majority is an NCDP campaign to end the Republican supermajority in the legislature. It has about 60 employees. Aim Higher Now, which has 14 workers, is a project of North Carolina Citizens for Protecting Our Schools that promotes investments in education, the environment, and expanding voting access. Anthony Harrison started working as a field organizer for Break the Majority in September, and like most campaign employees, is passionate about the cause. But that passion has pushed to its limit, he said, when he was pressured to go out in the field during an outbreak of gout. I thought, man, we should be unionized, Harrison said. The conditions driving the Break the Majority workers to unionize are largely those that prevail across the entire campaign industry. Stuff like long hours, low wages, lack of a voice and work conditions, and they were all present here. break the majority voted to unionize in September and gained recognition from the NCDP last month. While declining to go into the specifics of the collective bargaining agreement, Harrison says it contains a cap on work hours and a new discipline process for employees. Aim Higher Now was able to negotiate a 40-hour work week, says organizer Noreen Elmnadi. The industry standard is between 80 and 100 hours. We saw this as a great opportunity to live the campaign's values, Elmnadi said. Aim Higher Now is full of amazing people, and we as a unit decided that we wanted to give ourselves better hours and be leaders in that way. The Campaign Workers Guild, which represents 28 campaigns nationwide, facilitated negotiations for both unions. While a guild representative has a seat at the bargaining table, the workers drive the process, says Guild Secretary Ihab Sayed. Break the Majority and Aim Higher Now are the first North Carolina campaigns to unionize with the guild. As such, Sayed says, there's a good chance that they are the first set of political workers to unionize in North Carolina ever. That's an important benchmark that could encourage other campaign workers to collectively bargain for better working conditions. One of the great things we're doing is we're helping empower a huge group of workers to do contract negotiations, Sayed said. That's really important in an industry that has not been unionized before. North Carolina AFL-CIO President Mary B. McMillan applauded the workers' efforts, saying, "It's crucial for progressive organizations to walk the walk. The movement has to start from within, and if we say that we're for justice and fairness, then we've got to respect our own workers' rights to organize and have working-life balance and decent wages," McMillan said. "It especially sets an example for other progressive organizations." And now, this week's cover story on local style. Here's the guide. Style is a story we tell about ourselves. Personally, I became preoccupied with clothes at a young age. It started as far back as grade school when I had strong fashion preferences whose influences elude me now. Well, not all of them. My desire for jam shorts and neon-colored gotcha shirts is easily traced to the popularity of skate and surf culture of the late 80s. But where I got the idea that a white turtleneck with a gold herringbone chain and a cardigan was a sweet look, I'll never know. Still, School Day Picture Day's record records from the time, completely with a rat tail hairstyle, that if you catch the right year, that they attest that I certainly did think so. What was I copying with that look? In any case, my fashion sense has gone through lots of changes, lots of ups and downs since then, many for the better, some, however, and probably for the worse. There are the 90s high school era of freely mingling punk and preppy clothes, which reflected my musical tastes of mall punk and alt-rock and gangster rap. And there was a mercifully brief but confusing post-high school moment when I dabbled in raver, steel bead necklaces, absurdly oversized JNCO jeans, the whole thing. There was the die-hard indie rocker phase of nothing but band T-shirts and thrift store finds, grommeted leather belts and chain wallets. There were also the short intermittent dalliances with a sort of gappy young professional look, at moments when I thought I might try a normal life, though I often felt like I was wearing a costume and it would never stick. And then there's whatever the hell my style is now. It's hard to see except in retrospect. It mainly consists of the flossier things I can find at Plato's Closet and vintage finds or modern reproductions of the skate and surf gear of my youth. Though my style has come full circle in that way, it retains traces of these phases and all the others I've been through, like the rings of a tree. It's just that now, well, into adulthood, I can blend them into something richly my own. I can tell the whole story of my life through clothes. As you read and reflect on this issue, I hope you'll see that you can, too. Honorable mentions. Social media helps local designers blend fashion and art, financial necessity, and fashionable exclusivity. Sometime between the rise of the internet and the dominance of social media, if you wanted to sell your own clothing brand online, you needed upfront money to start a website or to use online stores such as Big Cartel, Volusion, and Zazzle. These sites are geared towards sellers who have a large backstock of the same screen-printed t-shirt designs in multiple colorways. But in the Instagram era, independent designers can explore their ideas on the smallest, most creative scale with less startup capital and no backstock. Selling one-of-a-kind pieces directly to customers, fashion artists can experiment instead of paying a carrier site fees that almost demand you make multiple copies of pieces to cover the cost. The triangle fashion scene is on its way, but it's still sort of being swept under the rug by the music scene and the visual art scene, says Durham-based designer Evita Loca. I still think some people feel like fashion should not be considered art. But Loca, who makes big personality women's wear that crosses the board from polka dot goth dresses to cowhide bell-bottoms, is one of the local people working to change that. Another is Durham's Blaine Carteau, who does vibey visuals and merchandising for local music collective Roundhouse, who carries this aesthetic into his re-upcycled designs as Cool Boy 36, which are printed, bleached, or hand-painted on repurposed shirts. Loca has a retail spot in downtown Durham at 115 Market Street, but she also gains most of her clientele online, as do many local designers outside the precincts of Runaway. Now that I'm making a lot of one-of-a-time-all pieces, I'm able to post something on Instagram as opposed to having to make a listing on a Big Cartel and sending some money to that. I can send the same photos cross-platform to Facebook and Twitter as well, and just include a message to DM me for purchases. For designers working in these channels, exclusivity is both a financial necessity and a selling point. If there's a limited amount of something, it's automatically a special edition, which commands higher prices. Even if you're new to the fashion world, you can work within your budget for the upfront cost to make one piece, price it as one of a kind, and profit. That whole notion started as, I don't have any money. I can only make one of these. But people actually really appreciate that. There's only one, so I better get it now, Loca said. Durham designer Donta Bliva, who goes by his brand's moniker, Paradiso, at Paradiso, says he had his first encounter with the power of social media and fashion about 3 years ago when his cousin in New York called him to come up for the summer and help him with a clothing brand he was starting. After making a shirt that caught the attention of then-up-and-coming, but not incarcerated for weapon possession, rapper Bobby Shmurda, he learned the speed of feedback social media outlets can provide. In the time span of 2 hours, we got about 4,000 likes, and we got a reply back from Bobby Shmurda asking to get one, Bliva said. He's sporting a Cool Boy 36 shirt, Gatorade yellow with a screen-printed face outline and chain links. Bliva says they met at a show they did together back in April, and he really liked Carteau's stuff. As opposed to conventional fashions in which lines are kept under wraps for long periods of time and then released all at once, social media allows for a steady stream of new creations. Bliva even lets people in on his mess-ups via Instagram. For example, this story recently included a photo in which he stitched P-R-I-D-D instead of P-R-I-D-E. He thinks of Instagram as his blackboard, where he can toss out any idea at all, which gives him the freedom to move on to the next one. You have to produce. It doesn't always have to be your best. It can just be your trail along the way. Just leave that trail of breadcrumbs, and that in turn becomes your stepping stone, said Belieba. The rapid pace makes him prolific. Instead of brainstorming so long, just send it out. Boom! I'm getting feedback. It's keeping me energized, keeps me wanting to create more. It may be impossible not to find something you like nowadays, both for shoppers and for local designers in search of new inspiration, contacts, and collaborators. Just clicking through link after link after link of profiles, it's that constant movement where you can find those niche areas and scenes, says Carteau. And Belieba says that when he first got into fashion, he used social media to see what had already been done in order to figure out what he could do. Trends seem to formulate like water on a herd of sheep, he said. If it seems to go this way, Paradiso is going completely rogue. And why not? Why not indeed? Fashion is not widely seen as an art form outside of its true believers, which makes it a perfect site for a gritty, flourishing, artistic underground. Next, full circle. I went to Ethiopia with Raleigh's The Flourish Market to learn how to give, but I got so much in return. On my last day in Ethiopia, I visited a leather goods factory where women and men with HIV/AIDS make beautiful leather purses for the company Able. The Flourish Market sells goods from Able in its Raleigh store where I had bought the clutch I was carrying, which made in the very rooms. Everything was coming full circle. It had never occurred to me that a small boutique opening on the ground floor of my apartment building in Raleigh would lead me here. 5 years ago, I moved from Michigan to Raleigh, where I manage a team of consultants in the pharmaceutical industry. 2 years ago, walking my dog each night, I saw a small lease space in my building starting to transform. Returning from a Thanksgiving weekend trip, I was surprised to suddenly find a store filled with beautiful goods made by artisans across the globe. As I read the tags on the garments, I realized the place had a larger purpose. Every purchase was helping someone change the trajectory of his or her life. The Flourish Market began as a fashion truck before opening its brick-and-mortar store on Tucker Street in 2016. Its partners with brands around the world that provided dignified jobs and fair wages to inspiring artisans and makers in vulnerable communities. It also donates a portion of sales from specific merchandise to Help One Now, a collective of churches, businesses, and individuals that financially support local leaders of populations in extreme poverty, especially those caring for orphans. I love the idea that my purchases could have a greater purpose. Why buy a shirt that was possibly made in a sweatshop when I could buy one made by a woman who has escaped human trafficking in Nepal? A new scarf that supports orphanages in India? A candle that provides meals to those in need? That Christmas, I bought all my gifts from the Flourish Market. It became the biggest monthly expenditure on my credit card. As I got to know owner M. Sexton and her crew of amazing women, something started stirring inside of me. When the Flourish Market partnered with Help One Now to build a home in Kairos Village in Peru for girls rescued from human trafficking, I realized that even a small stone can help build a home. M. told me about the potential for a trip to Ethiopia to meet women my purchases had helped and sponsor into the Family Empowerment Program, which is funded by Help One Now and run by local leaders in Ethiopia. I wanted to see the impact my shopping was having, to meet the people behind the work Help One Now is doing, and to figure out how I could support the growth of the Family Empowerment Program. As my trip to Ethiopia would show me firsthand, a garment from the Flourish Market is always so much more than just a pretty top. We arrived in Addis Ababa on a Sunday morning. After a 13-hour flight from Washington, D.C. at the airport, we were greeted by Ashlu Adebi, the director of Kidmia and Beloved, local organization Help One. Now partners with the Jerusalem Haili, also known as Jerry, a member of the Kidmia and Beloved teams. We spent Sunday learning about the local leaders and Ethiopian history and visiting two shops. One was started by a woman who hires people who were considered outcasts because of ailments like leprosy, tuberculosis, and HIV/AIDS, to make good for a fair wage so they can buy medicine. The other was run by a woman who was inspired by the Tom's practice of giving away a pair of shoes for every pair sold. She employed weavers to make traditional blankets for a living wage and safe working conditions, which they weren't accustomed to. She donates one blanket to women and children living in higher elevations around Addis Ababa who don't have shelter to keep them warm for every three sold. On the second day, we set out for Gernsher, where we would meet women who had gone through the Family Empowerment Program and see one of the orphanages run by Beloved and Kidmia. Meeting Berka, the first woman ever enrolled in the Family Empowerment Program, was incredibly humbling. When she was chosen to attend the program, she was suffering from HIV, her husband was in prison for life, and her kids were not able to live with her. 5 years later, she is thriving. Reunited with her children, all of whom are in school, she has multiple successful businesses. Then we met with Tecumseh Mish, who had received her business training about 8 months ago. She started a coffee and tea shop in her neighborhood, where she now makes roughly $12 a day, as opposed to $1 as a day laborer. Her children no longer have to work during the daytime and are going to school. She is sending her son to university, which would have been unthinkable prior to starting her business. On the third day, we traveled to Wolata Soto to meet with more women who had gone through the program and one who is going to start soon. We spent a few days there, and we were able to get to know Emabet, who exemplifies doing good with your talents and gifts. She has 7 children. And her husband was very ill and unable to work. She went through the program and started a neighborhood coffee and tea shop, which has allowed her to employ women and to open a mini shop, think very small convenience store, which she now employs her husband because she was able to get him the medicine he needed. All 7 of her children are in school, and she has paid the school fees for 5 additional children. Imbed also started a co-op with 15 women who meet weekly to help one another grow their businesses. Ask why she does what she does to help others in her community, Imbed says, "We may not have enough to give, but we have enough to share." Her words have encouraged me to share what I am given, and my time in Ethiopia is something for which I'll be forever grateful. I will never forget the spirit and the tenacity of the women we met. They continue to serve as inspiration when I'm faced with adversity. Since returning home, I have sponsored a child in Gunsher through Help One Now. On Thanksgiving, the Flourish Market is kicking off a campaign to sponsor 30 women in 30 days by raising $30,000 for Family Empowerment Program. It's a great time to get involved. Just in time for holiday shopping. Next, body language. I used to hate how I looked in clothes. Then I learned to make them speak my truth. Some people style themselves with natural ease as though they have a congenital intuition about the colors, shapes, textures, and patterns that signal their aspirations and hang gracefully from their bodies. I was never one of them. For most of my life, I gave little thought to clothes, or if I did, those thoughts came from a place of frustration and intimidation. Looking good felt like an impossible deal. Then 2 years ago, I volunteered to write a piece for the Indy's 2016 Style Guide, our first ever, that sought to demystify clothes shopping for people who hate it as much as I did. Ashley McIntyre, a personal shopper, taught me some basic outfit assembly skills and kindly encouraged me to try new possibilities for myself. I expected the assignment to be a learning experience, but 2 years later, I now see that it actually changed my life. I was a skinny child, to the point that it attracted regular comments from my family. I vividly remember my grandmother's frequent exclamation, "Thin as a rail!" Then puberty hit, and as I started putting on weight, I could see myself becoming the fat one among my middle school peers. I became ashamed of my body, so I started to hide it under boxy crew-neck t-shirts, loose-fitting jeans, and oversized hoodies. I sought to repel anyone who might look my way. For years, most of my decisions about clothing revolved about what I thought would make me least repulsive, least likely to attract the cruel comments that I heard about fat people everywhere in my life. I refused to wear shorts or tank tops during some summers because I considered myself too corpulent to enjoy such comforts in public. It seemed delusional to consider myself physically desirable or attractive, so feminine items like short skirts and flouncy dresses appeared to be absolutely off-limits to someone with a body like mine. Following a serious illness and a lifelong autoimmune diagnosis in the summer of 2013, I gradually started easing up on myself. I could continue my active self-loathing and make myself sicker, or accept my body as is and focus on healing it. But my adventure with McIntyre ushered in a new era of how I felt about my clothes and my body. I realized I could like clothes and like how I felt in them. Unusual prints and cuts began revealing themselves to me in ways that felt like magic, as with a homemade jungle print dress I found at a thrift store. It fits as though a stylish angel with my measurements made it, as does an astonishing black and gold vintage jumpsuit. I discovered during a recent procrastination-driven bout of thrifting, at least nothing feels like it's off-limits. Bright colors, high hems, velvet, accordion pleats, even sequins. Dear God, do I love sequins, the way they glimmer and the amount of light, the way they hushed rustle sounds when reverent whispers. I'm still fat, and through these bold sartorial choices, I feel like I'm making up for all of those years of diminishing myself. I take up as much space as I want, delighted in the prospect of disgusting those who might take offense at a fat woman daring to flaunt herself, learning how I want to dress myself, along with the understanding that I can do that however I want. This has carried the same wonder and thrill as learning a new language. I can translate my inner values, moods, and personality into an outward manifestation that tells the truth about who I am. When friends have commented on my noticeable change in style, I joke that I've lost my mind. But it feels more like finding a part of myself than losing one. My weird, outrageous clothes feel like a genuine reflection of my weird, outrageous self. I still wear t-shirts and jeans to work most days because I like them, not because I hate myself. I feel free, and not because it turns out that shirts and dresses can be as comfortable as pajamas. Changing my wardrobe hasn't completely eradicated the body image issues. I've wrestled for more than 15 years with them. There are still days where I face myself in the mirror on the edge of tears, wishing it were possible to live some sort of shapeless, bodiless existence. But now I have far fewer days where regarding my body as a demilitarized zone feels like as good as it's ever going to get. Developing my own style has helped me find a place where I can fully, finally enjoy being myself. I wouldn't trade that for all the sequins in the world. The next article, Fashion Plates. chefs tap local potters to craft serveware that blends function and style, surprise and delight. Michelle Vanderwalker guides me past the herb garden and the pantry shelves of preserves and pickles destined for cocktails at Kingfisher, the Durham cocktail bar she plans to open early next year with her husband, Sean Umstead. Then she leads me through the backyard to her home studio. This airy space, outfitted with a custom-built slab roller, a massive work table, and shelves of ceramic prototypes, is where Vanderwalker hand makes all of Kingfisher's ceramic cups, coasters, and bar-top tiles. In addition to serveware for restaurants such as County House and the St. Rock Fine Oysters Plus Bar, Vanderwalker is one of several talented local potters who, in addition to producing their own lines of work, collaborate with Triangle chefs and restaurants to create custom serveware that blends form, function, and style. What you eat and drink from any of may seem like a subtle part of the restaurant experience, but in a time when local food is an oft-copped buzzword, chefs who are as intentional about their plates as they are about their ingredients are creating truly local restaurants. At a time when diners are more discerning than ever, with more choices, these types of design details have the power to distinguish one restaurant experience from another. It's not necessarily something that people think about going into restaurants. They're not going in and be disappointed that their silverware isn't unique. But I think it's a really nice surprise, and I think surprises are a really underrated element of the dining experience. If you can be a little bit surprised and delighted by a detail such as the serveware being unique, and then you ask about it and find out that it's made by someone locally, that elevates your experience of that restaurant. A beautifully handcrafted plate reflects the level of care that a chef puts into preparing and serving a dish, especially since we eat with our eyes first. And though there is some uniformity, each ceramic piece is truly unique due to the variety of clays, glazes, and firing processes. Noticing the subtle flecks of texture on a plate adds another visual element to eating or Instagramming a dish. Kingfisher's cups add texture and a tactile element that you might not otherwise get when you're sipping a cocktail. Holding one of the Kingfisher's rock glasses, it sits differently in your hand than a glass one. And even if you didn't notice it was ceramic, you can't miss the short spikes protruding from its sides. Ditto that for the fruit and vegetable relief on the tiki mugs, which also serve as a subtle nod to Kingfisher's produce-driven cocktails. There's texture on that mug. There's something tactile, so it feels different than holding a clear glass in your hand, Vanderwalker said. It's fun to get a different cup. It feels like it'll be a different experience before you taste it. Working with local potters also shows the chefs care about community. It's more expensive, but besides getting a unique product, they're also supporting local businesses. And for chefs who are diligent about ingredient sourcing, it makes sense to apply the same diligence to their dishware. To me, I look at the same way I source our food. I want to create a relationship. I would like to get to know those people, to know their history. And her story, Jake Wood, chef de cuisine at Raleigh's 18 Seaboard, says. It brings a lot more to the plate when you start to talk about your ingredients. And I treat our plates just like an ingredient. It's a main ingredient of our dishes, so to speak, because it's our blank background. As a result, 18 starboard salmon and turquoise spring-summer plates will make way for others with a neutral color palette and a more rustic feel for fall-winter. Last year, Wood started working on Matt Halliburton of Hollywood Pottery in Rutherford College in Western North Carolina. All of Halliburton's work is handmade using North Carolina clay, some of which he digs himself and is fired in a wood-burning kiln, whose ashes and flames leave subtle, unique marking on each piece. In addition to the striped back color palette, Halliburton's new line for 18 Seaboard reflects its philosophy of creating plates that are harmonious with the food. Wood says the new plates really allow the colors and textures of the fall ingredients to pop. Slices of rosy duck breast are fanned out alongside a butternut squash, mustard, a lavender-hued muscadine whip, and green Brussels sprouts, whose charred and caramelized edges pick up the speckles of the plate's own wood fire ashes. An 18 Seaboard finalized its fall-winter menu development and plating style. Wood provides feedback to Halliburton to inform the final look and feel of the plates. We can collaborate the same way we would with a farmer, Wood says. The same way we might need a different size or quality of a vegetable, we can collaborate with Matt on the size, edges, and rims of the plate. Mark Warren and Chris Pence, co-owners of Hand, a pottery company in Burlington, took a similar collaborative approach when working with Chef Michael Lee at M. Sushi. It was also a keen reminder that no matter how beautiful, the pieces had to be functional. Warren recalls one sculptural piece that ultimately made a better paperweight than a plate, and that they steered away from creating pieces that curved inward in too much because they collected water in the dishwasher. Besides being functional and aesthetically pleasing, tableware can help reflect a chef's overall vision for a restaurant. When Ashley Christensen opened Death and Taxes, her restaurant devoted to cooking with wood fire, she tapped Hand. Ashley had a clear idea of what her menu was going to be and the color she wanted. It was really important to have a foundation to build on, not only the function of the plates, but also as a design element within the restaurant. Because Death and Taxes is housed in a former bank, Warren used money as an inspiration to develop a specific shades of brown, gray, and green for the restaurant's serveware, copper pennies, silver dimes, green bills. It's referencing it, but not making it your face, Warren says. It doesn't matter if the customer knows that it's referencing money or the history of the place as a bank, but it's part of that experience. It seems to be clear that someone chose that color, a specific kind of green. The glazes also incorporate leftover wood ash from Death and Taxes grill, so depending on the type of wood the kitchen uses, the ash and glaze melt differently, creating varying rivulets and ripples. And the texture can skew more toward a creme brulee-like finish or something smoother depending on the temperature or thickness of the glaze, or where the place sits in the kiln. You want some element of chaos because that's what creates the indefinable thing that makes it good and different, said Warren. The next article, fantastic local shops and brands and where to find them. The Art of Style. At The Art of Style, the look is chic, cosmopolitan, and modern, with a monochromatic palette that would please even the most fashion-forward urban dwellers. The store carries men's and women's clothes by a slate of distinctive designer brands, familiar names like Kenneth Cole, along with North Carolina brands like Wilmington's Forge and Foundry, hip footwear from Bedstoo, and specialty items like heavenly socks made in Italy by Punto. Look here for that cool item your closet is lacking. 21 West Hargett Street in Raleigh. Chet Miller. This home decor center on Durham's Perry Street offers a carefully curated, eclectic selection of gifts and artifacts by top designers, from high-end furniture to lamps, wallpaper, and prints. Founded by the people behind Parker and Otis, it's also a down-to-earth purveyor of charming doodads of every sort. Trinkets, barware, soap, globes, thermoses, and nature paintings. The store features more men-centric items, think beard maintenance tools, than your average upscale gift emporium. 118 West Perry Street in Durham. Deco Raleigh. This home furnishings company features the work of a bevy of talented local artists and artisans, so its merchandise is not what you'll find elsewhere. In a pleasantly cluttered atmosphere of fun and discovery, it's easy to lose yourself in the aisles of quirk. Kids' books and the greeting cards, refrigerator magnets, mugs and jewelry, and the store's relaxed vibe encourages laid-back browsing. 207 South Salisbury Street in Raleigh. Edge of Urge. Beginning humbly in 2002 with owner Jesse Williams selling handmade clothing accessories out of a tiny space in Wilmington, Edge of Urge's Raleigh location is now a vibrant presence on Franklin Street, offering the work of innovative designers of uncommon items. Women's clothing, jewelry, and accessories, baby clothes, or art for your home. The store also keeps a lively schedule of workshops and special events. But above all, the minds behind this emporium know that finding the perfect item brings a visceral thrill, and they strive to deliver that frisson to their customers. 215 East Franklin Street, Suite 110 in Raleigh. Exotique. Exotique has flourished for a decade on Durham's West Main Street with a focus on jewelry, art, and clothing made by an international creative community. It's a gift store, boutique, and gallery with a distinct sensibility and commitment to community. Come for handbags from Guatemala in dazzling hues, Ghanaian shirts for men, fabrics from many nations, soaps and lotions, and a range of jewelry and object d'art to fit a range of budgets. 319 West Main Street in Durham. Gypsy Jewel. Quite adamantly, Gypsy Jewel doesn't want to be called a boutique. It's too frou-frou for what we do, the website explains. The preferred term, misfit mercantile. What does that mean? Rugged and adventurous, urban and rustic, unconventionally bohemian. Everything from fashionable boots to glassware, skirts to jeans. 207 West Davie Street in Raleigh. Holder Goods and Crafts. This sun-filled space in downtown Raleigh is a furniture store, an art gallery, and an interior design firm, as well as a showcase for the work of local artisans, potters, and craftspeople. It's also an agora where you'll come and find an alluring stream of rarefied objects and curious curated with a sharp and appreciative eye. Vintage items such as coffee mugs and glassware, along with contemporary goods ranging from animal skulls to African mud clothes. 612 West South Street in Raleigh. And Julian's. Alexander Julian may be best known as the man who made the Argyle pattern synonymous with Tar Heel basketball and designed the Charlotte Hornets' early uniforms. But you won't find sportswear in this Chapel Hill shop. Instead, Julian provides an array of slick belts, Argyle sweater vests, and crisp dress shirts for men, and standout jackets, intricate tops, and elegant scarves for women. 135 East Franklin Street in Chapel Hill. Port of Raleigh. The carefully curated selection in this home furnishing store reflects an aesthetic honed by the owners over decades, surveying the world for the simplest, most practical, and pleasing home essentials. Elegant lines and a clean look pervade the collection, from clocks and tables to vases and chain charging cables designed to simplify your digital clutter. This is a can't-miss place for a cool wedding gift, and it's affordable enough to buy yourself something, too. 416 South McDowell Street in Raleigh. Possibilities Boutique. This small independent women's clothing emporium reflects its owner's quarter century in the business with a look that's bold and feminine, but also comfortable and seemingly effortless. Tunic-style tops are matched with dresses and light, often diaphanous fabrics, all in the range of natural fibers, reflecting the spirit of ease and positivity the store aims to foster. Possibilities also carries an interesting assortment of handcrafted jewelry and a range of accessories tailor-made to complement the store's vision of style. 1247 Kildare Farm Road in Kerry. Revolver Consignment Boutique. Recycling makes good sense, especially when it comes to purchasing upscale clothes at prices that are affordable to the average person. Revolver has offered a blend of modern and vintage, designer and retro clothes for more than a decade. And it has earned a reputation as a place where you can shop in a pleasant, unhurried, well-organized environment and leave with at least one cool AF item that you just can't live without. 122 Glenwood Avenue South in Raleigh. Rumors. Shopping at a quality thrift store is one of the most satisfying and cost-effective ways to make your fashion discoveries. Opened in 2013, Rumors has quickly become a well-loved source for delivering and that elusive thrill of the find with its carefully selected range of vintage and modern styles. Denim, fur or leather, designer label or classic cartoon sweatshirt. New Year's Eve or Halloween. We hear Rumors has the goods. 106 North Graham Street in Chapel Hill. Cuerca Studio. Since moving her studio from San Francisco to Raleigh in 2014, goldsmith Lauren Ramirez has filled it not only with heirloom quality jewelry, but a collection of curated gifts and store decor that contributes to an offbeat, rustic feel. Pieces are crafted in-house, but the studio also stocks pieces from designers across the country. The studio, which sits in the heart of the city of Oaks, derives its name from the scientific nomenclature for oak tree. 201 South Salisbury Street in Raleigh. The Stock Exchange. A contemporary consignment boutique, the Stock Exchange in Chapel Hill has been locally owned since 1985. It aims to provide shoppers with curated clothing at affordable prices, everything from Chanel bags to Burberry vintage hats to Tiffany & Company earrings, not to mention a wide selection of clothing. 6120 Farrington Road, Suite B, Chapel Hill. Trebella Boutique and Bridal Store. Trebella started as a home-operated florist shop in 2003, then added a high-end bridal store in 2008, and in 2014 found a permanent home in a 4,500-square-foot building on Main Street where the bridal shop combines with a women's boutique that offers smart fashion at a variety of price points. 124 East Main Street in Durham. TS Designs. This screen printing company has been plying its trade since 1977, long before the T-shirt ascended to its current status as a laid-back style staple and ubiquitous promotional giveaway. The firm revamped itself according to a green business model in the early 90s, a strategy that has kept it in the forefront of its industry, offering high-quality, sustainable apparel made of 100% North Carolina-grown cotton. 2053 Willow Springs Lane in Burlington. Vert and Vogue. V&V prides itself on offering cutting-edge looks for men and women that fulfill the owner's commitment to the work of green-minded designers and artisans. The clothing here is made exclusively from fine-quality natural fibers sourced from eco-friendly manufacturers and designers. This kind of attention to detail does translate into substantial price tags, but the quality of the materials means the clothing will last and keep looking good long after cheaper, more generic basics fall apart. 353 West Main Street in Durham. Voda Boutique. In 2017, North Carolina State grad Kayla Brewer opened Voda, a boutique on the bottom floor of a new apartment building on Tucker Street that offers everything from casual to trendy, night-on-the-town fashions, clutches, to booties, jeans, to sweaters. 725 Tucker Street in Raleigh. Then local brands. fly trap clothing. This experienced family-run screen printing company finds inspiration in the natural world, coming up with designs for its mostly women's apparel in its backyard workshop and selling throughout the country in high-end stores as well as internationally. All of its garments, dresses, tunics, scarves are designed and made by hand. Holy Aiken. This maker of classy practical bags and accessories has a distinctive style based on a color palette derived from retro items. A slew of merchandise, from handbags and messenger bags to diaper bags and wallets, are emblazoned with a pleasing geometry of chevrons, diagonals, and dot grids, or simple shapes like anchors or the state of North Carolina, providing a distinctive sensibility to these wares. 20 East Hargett Street in Raleigh. House of Swank Clothing. Local screen printer and Frito Caster guitarist, a guitar made from Frito metal lunchbox, John Pugh churns out all manner of hip, kitschy, North Carolina-themed T-shirts. There's one with a 1920s map of Raleigh, another that shows the state divided by its barbecue sauce choices, tomato and vinegar, that sort of thing. 119 East Hargett Street in Raleigh. Munjo Munjo. Munjo Munjo bills itself as a seller of collaborative goods for overgrown children. Most distinctive are its anime-inspired T-shirts, pins, and stickers. But the company has sold everything from mugs to plants to dog treats during its 2 years on the scene. Nala Elise Clothing. The distinctive T-shirts and letterman jackets from Nala Elise have earned a lot of street cred from being worn by big names like Kevin Hart and Kerry Washington. But owner Rick Moore says his locally sourced clothing is for everyone, emblazoned with the slogans like, "Film is my ammo." These tees and tanks have an urban verve all their own. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And a reminder, this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So, until next week, goodbye. Good night, and good morning.